Good morning. We're here today with Mark Lindsay. He is an attorney and partner with Levine, Belasek, Bullock, and Boothby. And his specialty there is in IT transactions with an emphasis on outsourcing and software licensing. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi. How are you? Good afternoon, Jenny.
Thanks for being here today. We're going to talk a little bit about your law firm specialty and your own practice within it, especially as it relates to the issue of on-demand software. So can you give us a little bit of input on that?
Sure. Levine, Belasek, Bullock & Boothby, we all call it LB3 just to make it shorter. LB3 is a law firm in D.C. I'm 16 lawyers. It's a technology and telecom transaction boutique. We do some regulatory work before the FCC, but a good portion of our work is representing enterprise customers who are buying telecom and technology products and services. My specialty within that is on the technology side, the IT side. Outsourcing, managed services, application development, integration, software licensing, on-demand software, and web services is now becoming sort of tied with that concept. And I've been here at the firm for just over 8 years doing that.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's changed about on-demand software since the ASP buzz of the early 90s. Even if the terms have changed, it's gone through so many different permutations, hosting and ASP and on-demand. And besides the actual naming conventions, how what's changing in the arena is translating into benefits for the customer.
It has been a little bit of a turmoil, and unfortunately a good portion of the problem with the ASP models is that there's a lot of bad models out there that weren't generating a lot of income, put a bad name on the subscription software technology industry. It's now back with a little bit of a force because, number one, there's appropriate financial rigor being applied to companies that are selling it. And secondly, the technology underlying this new subscription model is a little bit more robust. And specifically, a good number, but not all. There's still some ASPs thriving out there on the old model. But the new software as a service or on-demand software that people are really excited about incorporates web services and service-oriented architectures. And what that provides from a technology standpoint is a much simpler way to build applications for the multi-tenant environment. You've got multiple customers running a single instance of the software, makes managing that software much less complicated, much less expensive, and it allows changes to happen in a much more efficient way. So the translation in terms of customers, the benefit we now have or experiencing, is that it allows customers a much simpler and lower cost opportunity to gain access to enterprise level software solutions that otherwise were either out of their reach because it was incredibly complex in the ERP implementation or CRM implementation, which was maybe too complex for small to medium sized companies. Even large companies with the resources struggled to get them implemented in a reasonable time frame without throwing a whole bunch of money at it. So the benefits now is that it's bringing to a different level, a different market, these enterprise software solutions at a lower cost point.
Well, when you talked about things like web services and the services-oriented architecture infrastructure, is one of the benefits that companies are extending to their customers through this kind of infrastructure the ability to make it easier to integrate with in-house or other third-party solutions from themselves or from other vendors, or is that still more of an anomaly?
The integration problem is still very difficult. There are some notable exceptions. There's an app exchange solution that Salesforce.com is sort of promoting that says Salesforce.com puts out its APIs or its program interfaces and says, here's what you can do to connect to my service. And they vet those solutions so that you can integrate certain third-party applications to Salesforce.com's application. Now, that's kind of unique. Other web services that are used as a part of the on-demand software delivery model, the integration problem has not yet been solved by the providers. There are a bunch of alternative providers like WebMethods and a few other companies who provide web service wrappers that a company itself, working hire a consultant, can come in and put a web services wrapper around some legacy applications or data stores. But now we're talking about essentially a custom software project. Mm-hmm. And so the economies of on-demand software where you're buying per user with low integration costs kind of go out the window. Right. You're no longer looking at a typical benefit analysis in that scenario. You're looking at no longer just being on-demand-ish or usage-based purchasing. You're now saying, I'm going to standardize my application environment on web services, and this can provide me an opportunity to integrate all these previously disparate data stores and applications, but that's an expensive proposition today.
Mm-hmm. So it's not really practical to choose a software as a service solution if you require that level of integration. I wonder if there are any other scenarios that should make a company sort of steer clear of software as a service or on-demand software, or any horror stories that you might share that could help illustrate that point.
That's a great question. Part of what happens, and the reason why on-demand solutions of today are mostly attractive to small, medium companies, with some exceptions, is because despite the sales literature and the salesman's pitch, they really cannot be customized to map to a customer-specific business processes. You gotta kind of go with what the vendor has put together for you. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do some minimal changes around the edges, making some selections and some options. But if you're a company that has a business process that you love, it's cutting edge, you think it puts you above your competition, then it doesn't make much sense to go with an on-demand solution, which is going to force you to abandon some of your uniqueness. Or, conversely, you're going to end up spending a whole lot of money developing an interface that's unique to you, which may be of no use once you migrate away from the on-demand solution. And again, one of the benefits of that on-demand solution is that you can kind of take the best of the breed while it's available and migrate to something else when it's not available. If you spend a lot of money customizing, you're kind of locking yourself into an on-demand model. You scratch your head and say, well, why don't I just buy an on-prem version that I can modify and keep in perpetuity?
So to flip the question around then, it's appropriate to look at software as a service as a model when you want to kind of be on the cutting edge, when you want something installed up and quickly. Are there any other things to keep in mind when that would be a good idea?
Yeah, if, you know, there's some good examples of companies, you know, that joint ventures who both may have their unique process, but they can't agree to use that unique process when they come together in the joint venture, then they can standardize on some neutral barrier, neutral third-party solution, I should say, and adopt that business process as their own. That's another good example. It also makes sense if you have an existing legacy application that is really limping along, and it's time to look at a completely different solution for that. And again, I'm more of a conservative on this issue. I'm still uncomfortable recommending the clients that they consider this for anything that is really cutting edge in terms of competitive advantage in their environment. Not cutting edge in terms of technology, but if it's really something that is unique to that particular company, I'm saying to, you know, most customers now, you know, you may not want to pursue the on-demand solution in that respect. So absent that scenario, cutting edge technologies that aren't unique to a particular business, great idea. Joint ventures who want to have a standard, want to standardize on some other process, great idea. Even existing companies whose process may be broken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good opportunity to start looking at eliminating the IT bottleneck of complex applications that are old and don't map to efficient processes, and standardizing on those that are maybe simpler than they otherwise would be if you generated it at home. Mm-hmm. But it allows you to focus more on the process and get away from focusing so much on the underlying technology associated with delivering a certain set of functionality to your ultimate end user.
So once you've decided that perhaps this is the right way for your company to go for a particular reason, what factors do you have to take into consideration when you're thinking about entering into a software as a service contract that maybe you wouldn't for a run-of-the-mill in-house software licensing deal or even a typical outsourcing deal? What's different? What do you have to watch out for?
The first point, and it's sometimes the one overlooked because it's so obvious, and that is one of the selling points of on-demand is the ability to, you know, only what you need, you know, to buy the number of seats, typically a seat-based licensing model, number of seats in a given month that correspond to your usage. But funny enough, the transactions I get involved in, the pricing models aren't initially that flexible. You know, there may be provisions for how the price goes up when more seats are added, but it doesn't seem to be, it's not a one-for-one correspondence when the seat numbers go down.
Mm-hmm.
So developing a licensing pricing model that really is flexible to deliver the promise on the on-demand nature of these solutions is a critical discussion. A part of what you need to avoid is any consumption minimums. Like a lot of times vendors will say, you've got 10,000 employees. In order to preserve this pricing that I'm giving you, you got to have 5,000 seat licenses. And maybe only 6,000 employees intend to use it. Now, there's a couple ways that'll get you if you're not careful. If it is strictly a discount model, where if you fall below the number, the price goes up a little bit, not unreasonable. Have to look at what it means from a financial implication standpoint. But a lot of times what these numbers will mean is that if you fall below it, then you still have to pay that fixed amount anyway. So, you know, you sign up for 5,000, you start out using 6, you have a spin-off or something happens, you're down to 4,000 seats. Your contract may obligate you to spend 5,000 seats worth of usage charges. So that needs to be. Service levels are also providers are not offering meaningful service levels to their customers. Some are now starting to see the need for availability service levels, but that's just scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. Any IT professional realizes that availability is good, but if it's the application is so slow that the process that I'm seeking to initiate craps out or something else happens, then it might as well not be available.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of reading of the fine print before you sign on the dotted line. What about the question of security? That's always a concern for customers who think about taking an internal process and hosting it on an external source. Are there certain risks there, and what protections should they seek if there are?
Yeah, Jane, that's also a great point, that is a little bit different in the on-demand world, and that is, you know, on-prem software, the database is usually your infrastructure. The primary data store is in your infrastructure. You may have a secondary store that you have some disaster recovery sites that are belong to someone else, but you own it. And if it's faulty, the security is faulty, it's your fault. And you can apply more resources. In this case, you have to then rely on the vendor's internal security procedures. And, you know, as a precondition to doing a deal, you need to have the vendor identify what security architecture it currently uses. Is it compliant with, you know, certain ISO standards that indicate that it has a certain maturity in its process? That's a good starting point. You want to examine the facilities where the data is going to be stored, whether they are in fact secure facilities. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of sources of vulnerabilities, particularly in a multi-tenant environment where a lot of these on-demand solutions, the data is stored, because now you have all these customers. That creates a fetch as a target for potential hackers. So there's got to be some appropriate amount of attention being paid to how the infrastructure is secure. Now, you know, it's always a matter of a little bit of reliance initially in the contracting phase, because on the sales cycle, you know, you may get all sorts of affirmations as to, you know, what security steps they take, but you got to document those in the contract. In addition to documenting what specific security requirements the provider uses, you want to have the right to audit. You know, you want to have the ability periodically to have a third party come in and verify that the security requirements that have been documented in your contract are in fact being honored, and having appropriate remedies in the event that they're not. In the context of security, it's, you know, somewhat difficult to negotiate that part of it, because vendors are going to be very skittish about allowing anybody to come in and verify their environment. So that's why a lot of times, if possible, you know, getting designations of ISO standards and having independent third parties who are in the business of certifying whether providers are in compliance is a nice way to kind of bridge the gap, because they can't argue. In order to get certified, you've got to, you know, go through some third party to get it certified, and you can't object to having that party come in and verify that the certification is still legitimate during the course of the transaction.
There's obviously another concern that I think a lot of companies would have besides the ones we've just discussed, and that would be sort of end of life of service issues. You maybe decide you want to try a different provider, but how do you make that move without creating trouble accessing or migrating your data?
My negotiations, we do spend a good considerable amount of time talking about the data issues and the, you know, sort of the prenuptial part of it, if you will, what happens when this deal is over. And the most, you know, it's somewhat mundane but important part of that is coming to some understanding as to what format that data will be available, made available to the customer at the end of the deal. Number one, ultimately, there should be a nice clear statement that says any data that is created, introduced, and derived from any data the customer provides belongs to the customer, period. There should be no qualifications on that. At the end of the deal, you should have unqualified right to get all that data back. The practical question is, it will be made available to you in a format that you can use at some point in time in the future. So figuring out, in your particular case, what might be the right data format and medium is something that has to be negotiated at the very beginning so the parties can have a realistic expectation of that. Secondarily, taking your data and then moving it into a new environment oftentimes requires some cooperation, export tools that you may have or the vendor may have, identifying them in your post-term transition plan, which kind of leads me back to a point that all needs to be within the scope of a provision, an attachment that says, here's what we will do when the deal is terminated or expired. And it shouldn't matter whether the deal is terminated or expired based on any number of events. You know, this is a critical thing that a customer needs to ensure continuity at the end of the deal. In addition to the data transition, data migration issues, some customers, this is a difficult one to deal with in the post-term migration planning. But, you know, it's something that some vendors will offer. And at this stage in on-demand software maturity, I encourage customers to push for it if possible. And that is, you want a right to take a perpetual license if the deal runs dead. You may decide that this on-demand model doesn't work for you. the vendor itself may be shaky on shaky financial grounds. There may be something that happens, you know, in the life of the transaction that says, you know what, I like this software, I like this solution, I've standardized on it, I've created all these nice interfaces to it, I want to now have it as a part of my environment. Some, not all, I mean, it depends on a lot of things, but some vendors at this stage will offer you the option to take a perpetual license at the end of the transaction so that you're not potentially left having to scramble to find a brand new solution if you really like the one that you've gotten.
Speaking of brand new stuff, obviously in the on-demand world, we've seen a lot of the applications that you would expect. CRM comes to mind is probably one of the more typical ones. We've also saw last week at Interop, ISS talked some more about some of its new on-demand security services and some that it's already been offering, like vulnerability patch management. You also have been following an announcement by Avaya in another kind of new on-demand service. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and what you see ahead for that.
Yeah, Avaya, very curious announcement. They're now going to be hosting a voice over IP solution. They're going to be selling this through resellers, so they're not sitting directly between the voice, the data network, and the voice service and customer, but they're going to be reselling it through their channel partners. And it raises some very interesting questions as to whether, you know, which provider in that chain is a regulated common carrier. You know, are they going to be subject to certain things like USF contributions? You know, are there going to be some other regulatory hurdles that are foisted on top of Avaya now that they are appearing to offer what looks like, from all indications, a pure telecom service? They've tried to dodge the bullet a little bit by not being the one who provides it onto the end user, but there's going to be some really challenging questions that come out of the telecom world as to whether or not this service now opens the box up for voice over IP in this arena, being a regulated telecommunications service by the FCC. And I'm certain that some of the existing providers of service like AT&T and Verizon will raise an eyebrow.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, Mark, I want to thank you for your time today. Really appreciate your educating us a bit on some of these matters.
Well, thank you. Very good discussion.